at the foot of a mountain.
Yes.
So they had a...
Well, a group of Nichiren monks who had come under the influence of Gandhi wanted a peace conference. And none of the Christian missionaries would have anything to do with it because the American embassy said, don't have anything to do with this peace conference. The communists will get control of it and they'll run it. And the Quakers were the only ones who were willing to cooperate with the Buddhists. So this whole conference, which had people in it from India and Australia and Ceylon, we had five or six Ceylon monks, some Quakers from the United States and other places.
Canada. What year was this?
What's that?
What year was
this? This was at the spring of 54. So everywhere we went, we were received by the mayor, and the Chamber of Commerce gave us a banquet, and we made speeches. At the end of the speeches, are there any questions? Are there any objections? Nobody had a thing to object to. And what we gave them was strict 100% pacifism, nothing else. And you can see from these quotations that the basic Hinduism and the basic Buddhism are definitely pacifist. That is, they're against injury, not only to human beings, but also to animals. Against taking life of any sort, even of ants, beetles, even mosquitoes, I think. That's going pretty far. Well,
should we have the Shinto quote from the prayer to the sun goddess?
Well, all right.
Let the under heaven be free from alarms, and all the country enjoy peace by thy help and protection.
Yes. Yes, that took quite a little searching to find a Shinto quotation. So at that particular time, fairly soon after the Second World War, the Japanese were very peace-minded, and I think they still are. The Constitution forbids them to have an army to be used as an instrument for national policy. Now, I thought today I would spend a little time. Not too much. I think in order to save time, you might just read one selection from the Hindu scriptures. See if it's that one about loving the self. Mm-hmm. Is that it?
Which self, O Yajnavalkya, is within all? Yajnavalkya replied, thou couldst not see the true seer of sight. Thou couldst not hear the true hearer of hearing. Nor perceive the perceiver of perception, nor know the knower of knowledge. This is thyself, who is within all. Everything also is of ego.
Yes, I thought that was something different.
Well, there is this section. It goes on. You can tell him. And he said, verily, a husband is not dear, that you may love the husband, but that you may love the self. Therefore, a husband is dear. And then
it goes on.
The wife.
You love the wife because you love the self. You love the son because you love the self. You see, there's only one self in the universe. There couldn't possibly be two. If there were two selves in the universe, how would they communicate? But we're all parts of the same self, capital S. And that self is the universe. That self is God. That self is everything. And Hinduism is essentially pantheistic, that is, the later forms of Hinduism. The earlier forms are quite primitive. The earliest forms of Hinduism are expressed in the Vedas, of which there are literally thousands of poems, all to the different gods. The Aryan invaders of India were probably brought the Vedas, the songs of the various deities. These deities are very much like the Greek and Roman deities. For instance, Agni is the god of fire. That's the Latin word ignis, same word, only in Sanskrit form. And other deities, poems to Indra. But the profounder Hindu religion, the so-called Vedanta, which is perhaps the most metaphysical, the most profound, and the ones represented by all the different Swami or Vishnu Ramakrishna centers in this country, that is essentially pantheistic, and everything that exists is some expression of Brahman. Now, it seems probable that the Brahman priests were not descended from the Aryan invaders. The Aryan invaders became the officials and the military and the bureaucrats that belonged to the second caste. The top caste, the Brahman caste, was probably descended not from the Aryan invaders of India, which invaded India about 1500 BC, but rather from a very much more ancient civilization. It's now sometimes called the Mohenjo-Daro civilization because the ruins of it happen to be near a city called Mohenjo-Daro, and it's supposed to go back to about 3,000 or 4,000 BC, and it's very similar in many ways to the most ancient ruins in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. It's in northwest India, in the Punjab, and these enormous buildings of this very, very ancient civilization, one of the oldest in the world, they still remain. But the English, when they made railroads, used these bricks as railroad foundations and took away a good many of the bricks. But of course, there's millions of them left. So it's very likely that the Aryan religion was more primitive than the Brahmin religion, which came from this much older civilization in northwest India, the remains of which have only fairly recently been discovered. Well, you see that idea of oneself, and that word, one of the words she read there, I shall be in him and he in me, that's almost a quotation from the Gospel of St. John. He that worships me, I shall come and dwell with him and he with me. That's from the Bhagavad Gita, and some of the phrases in the Bhagavad Gita are almost identical with phrases in the Gospel of John. And that's one of them. I think that quotation is from the Bhagavad Gita. I have some places marked there. I don't think we'll have time from them. I'll just quote Emerson. Emerson paraphrases one of the Gita, the songs in the Bhagavad Gita. Gita means song, and Bhagavad means God or Lord, the song of the Lord. If the red slayer thinks he slays, or if the slain think he is slain, they know not well my subtle ways, I come and pass and come again. Far and apart to me are near, close and asunder are the same. Vanished gods to me appear, and one to me are shame and fame. They reckon ill who leave me out. When me they fly, I am the wings. I am the doubter and the doubt, and I to him the Brahmin sing. The strong gods pine for my abode, and pine for me the sacred seven. But you, meek lover of the good, find me and turn your back on heaven. That is, Brahmin, if you doubt him, he's the very doubt with which you doubt him. He is the doubter and the doubt. If you try to flee from him, he's the wings by which you fly, so you can't get away from him. He is everything and everywhere, but he becomes especially incarnate in certain saints and certain legendary figures like Krishna and Rama, and there are two immensely long Hindu epics, much longer than the Iliad or Odyssey, and probably as old, called the Ramayana, which is about Rama and his wife Sita, and the Mahabharata, which is a story of a war between two tribes of in India. And some of those selections she read are in favor of non-injury, not injury to any living thing, come from those two immensely long epics. But the literature of Hinduism and Buddhism is so vast, it's hard to know what to select. Now I might spend a little time on a religion which is very similar. Hinduism is the oldest, and I imagine Hinduism did influence Taoism. Well, we know it influenced Buddhism, because Buddhism was a reformation of Hinduism. Just as Christianity came out of Judaism, so Buddhism came out of Hinduism. And after Buddhism grew up, first under the preaching of the Buddha himself, he lived till he was 80 and had a good many disciples when he died, and he already had established the Sangha, the order of monks. You take a vow, I take refuge in the Sangha, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma. The Dharma is the truth, or the religion, or however you may translate it. Well, before he died, he had a great many followers and several church councils in which they tried to decide what the true religion was, just as they tried to do in Christianity. Buddhism was different from Hinduism in this in several respects. In one thing, in one way, it's more democratic. See, Hinduism is tied in with caste. There's a Brahmin caste, and then there's the three lower castes, and then the outcast, and very sharp social distinctions in India, which are illegal, but just about as strong as ever. It's very difficult to eliminate class distinctions by law, as we're finding in this country. And it takes many years and a lot of intermarriage before that can possibly be done successfully. And Gandhi got laws passed outlawing the caste system, but still in the Indian villages the outcasts cannot drink at the same well as the other castes, or the caste. And a Brahmin will still not eat with a second or third class, I've forgotten the names of these castes, but it doesn't matter. That caste system is still there, although illegal.
But the Constitution of India was written by an outcast.
By an outcast, yes. The outcasts now have many privileges they didn't have before. Buddhism is more democratic. Also, Hinduism is very metaphysical and philosophical. Buddhism is purely psychological. Whenever his disciples asked the Buddha any philosophical questions or any theological questions, he just refused to answer. Are there any gods? He wouldn't answer. Who are the gods? And so on. He says, I have only one thing, and that is life is suffering, and my teaching is relief from suffering. Follow my teaching, and you will be freed from attachments which cause suffering, from the desire for property, from greed, from covetousness. That is the essence of Buddhism, to be freed from desire of any kind. And if you follow the teachings of the Buddha, you become so freed from desire that you are incapable any longer of suffering or of acquiring wealth or becoming proud and pompous or anything of that sort. But Buddhism did change, just as Christianity did, and just as very primitive Christianity developed into Catholicism, with lots of pageantry and lots of images and traditions, so Buddhism developed into Mahayana Buddhism in China and Japan, with a great many symbols and a great many different sects. One of the largest, I think I might have mentioned before, is the Shinshu sect, where you're saved by faith in Amida, the Buddha of infinite light. The word Amida means without measure. Mita is the same as our word metric. Without measure. The infinite Buddha, who never was incarnated on this earth. When I was first in Japan, I visited Mrs. Suzuki. Suzuki himself, who is the principal authority on Zen, was then in London. But Beatrice Suzuki was an American, and she took charge of me while I was in Kyoto, and One thing she arranged for me, which I hadn't, of course, planned for, she arranged a debate between me, all by myself, and the faculty of Oltani University, which is a very large university, and the head of the university, the wife of the head of the university, is the sister of the Empress of Japan. So it's quite a prestigious institution. Well, here I was, all by myself, debating with these 20 or 30 or 40 professors. And I asked them questions, and they asked me questions. Well, I asked them one question, which got them arguing with each other. I said, suppose a person on his deathbed, at the very last minute, would have faith in Amida. Would he go to Amida's heaven? Well, they were divided on that question. Some said yes, others said, no, it's too late. So instead of arguing with them, they start to argue with each other. That was one of Paul's strategies when he got to arguing with the Sanhedrin. He said, we are convicted because we believe in the resurrection. Well, the Sanhedrin was divided on that point, so they got so heated in their arguments with each other, they forgot all about Paul and what they were planning to do to him. Well,